Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Leora Tannenbaum will be on to talk about bad shoes and the women who love them. Also, looking at the impending reversal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and how the healthcare reform bill will start helping women prevent unintended pregnancy, eventually. Rand Paul claimed he was against the Civil Rights Act not because he's racist, oh no. It's because he claims that a strict reading of the Constitution and property rights meant that the act was unconstitutional, even though the courts disagreed. So what does strict constitutionalist Rand Paul think about the native-born citizens who are children of immigrants?
We're the only country I know of that allows people to come in illegally, have a baby, and then that baby becomes a citizen. And I think that should stop also.
Since this automatic citizenship is granted by the Constitution, I'm afraid we have to say that Rand Paul's strict reading of the Constitution seems not to include those instances where said strict reading breaks in favor of racial minorities. With the looming possibility of Republicans taking either the House or the Senate, or possibly both in the 2010 election, Democrats have gotten a little more hustle when it comes to knocking some easy wins off the agenda and hoping that improves their showing in 2010. And with 78% of the country supporting the right of gay people to serve openly in the military, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell is at the top of the list.
It's now up to the U.S. Senate to decide whether the time has come to lift the ban on allowing gays to serve openly in the military. Nevada supporters of lifting the ban spent the Memorial Day weekend celebrating their victory in the House and thanking Congresswomen Berkeley and Titus, who voted in favor of repealing the ban. The measure passed on a vote of 234 in support to 194 opposed.
Of course, it just goes to show how in thrall of a conservative minority D.C. is that this repeal is still a compromise bill, even with more than three-quarters of the country supporting it. The repeal won't go into effect until after the Pentagon has finished some review process, which sounds okay on paper, but leaves me concerned that a few homophobic bureaucrats could hold the whole process hostage. But what's really amazing is that some politicians are also flouting the majority opinion and acting like this wildly popular repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is the harbinger of the apocalypse.
The Senate Armed Services Committee voted in favor of including the repeal as part of the Defense Department spending bill. Some Republican senators are now threatening to filibuster the bill as a result. A spokesperson for Majority Leader Harry Reid said at a time when the nation is fighting two wars, Senator Reid cannot imagine anyone wanting to turn away qualified people who want to serve our country.
I think it has to just be political posturing, though. Filibustering this would mean filibustering all defense spending, which would basically shut down the military. I'm highly skeptical that even the most homophobic politician would let himself be the guy who shuts down the military just to make sure that gay people serving have to stay in the closet. But these politicians are between a rock and a hard place. They serve a base that is both obsessed with the military and uses that obsession to shore up their own psychological issues about masculinity. To them, the point of having a gazillion-dollar super-fancy military is make them feel like they've got the symbolic version of the biggest you-know-what on the block. Thus, letting gays in destroys the illusion for them. Of course, for the rest of us, having a military is about national defense, and oh yeah, those two wars plus change we're fighting. But as Keith Olbermann documented, Christian right groups are pulling out all the stops.
Family Research Council, Peter Sprigg, he told reporters yesterday, quote, protected class status for homosexuals would make victims hesitant to report assaults and make commanders hesitant to punish them for fear of appearing homophobic. According to Mr. Sprigg, quote, the most common type of homosexual assault is one in which the offender fondles or performs oral sex on a sleeping victim. Cliff Kincaid of the America's Survival Group, also of Accuracy in Media, warns of an army of cross-dressing corporal clingers His group also produced a 10-minute-long YouTube video which warns disease-tainted gay blood threatens our troops. Open and active homosexuals in the U.S. military could very well result in the spreading of deadly HIV-tainted blood throughout the ranks.
I think there's some confusion about how HIV is spread going on. That, or Cliff Kincaid thinks that allowing gay soldiers to come out of the closet will result in nonstop orgies of unprotected anal sex. And let's face it, he probably does think that. But that wasn't even the worst of it.
This is Brian Fisher from a group called the American Family Association.
Hitler himself was an active homosexual. Straight soldiers to be savage and brutal and vicious enough to carry out his orders, but that homosexual soldiers basically had no limits in the savagery and brutality they were willing to inflict on whoever Hitler sent them after. So he surrounded himself. Virtually all of the stormtroopers, the brown shirts, were male homosexuals.
That's what I like to call wishful thinking. It's kind of funny, actually, how much projection is going on. The ugly truth is that Nazi Germany agreed with the Christian right about gay people, and therefore the Nazis gathered gay people up and gassed them in the concentration camps, which is a little different than the claims that Hitler put together the homosexual army to destroy Europe. Catering to these fanatics is just a bad idea, and you're getting more and more Republicans who want to stay in the mainstream cluing into that fact. Former Bush advisor Matthew Dowd was on ABC's This Week and talked about how his son, who is in the military, says that the support is all on the side of repealing the ban on gays in the military.
My son explains, they all sit around and talk about it. They go to high school with kids that are now openly gay. They socialize with kids that are openly gay. And all of a sudden they go in the armed services, or services, somebody gives them a rifle and they're not supposed to be around gay people anymore. It doesn't make any sense. It's long been decided in the public's mind. I think the Republicans are so far out of step on this, where the country is, especially the generation.
Well, it's Republican office holders, right? Because Republican people are in favor of repealing the ban.
Yeah, Republican office holders are so far out of step with this. And so
the only reason for anyone in either party to stall on this issue is that they're in the thrall of a fanatical hard-right minority that shouldn't have their ear in the first place.
I'd like to welcome Leora Tannenbaum to the program. Leora is an author whose previous book, titled Slut, is a feminist classic. She has a new book out called Bad Shoes and the Women Who Love Them, and she's here today to talk about this book. Welcome to RealityCast, Leora.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I have to say, this book makes even more sense to me since I moved to New York just a few months ago and have really learned what it means to walk everywhere.
Oh, that's so funny. And Amanda, let me ask you, what kind of shoes do you walk around in?
I was a fan of flat shoes before, but I have like 2 to 3 pairs of like high heels that I would wear on special occasions when I lived in Texas, and now they're useless.
Well, they're not useless. You just can't walk around in them. I wouldn't say they're useless. What do you walk around in?
Either sneakers or like flat shoes when I have to dress up a little.
Right. You're smart. I wish more New York women, or more women in general, followed your lead.
Well, what inspired you to write a book about how women fall into the habit of wearing like unhealthy, painful shoes?
I know. It may seem like an unusual topic for me to choose, given that I had never written about fashion or health before. So people seem a little bit surprised. But as with all my books, it really came out of my own experience. I'm 40 years old, and about 2 years ago, my feet started to hurt. And I really had no clue what was going on. I do wear heels, but not every day. I've never been a real fashion plate kind of a person. I mean, I do like to get dressed up. I do like to wear heels, but it was always in moderation. And, you know, my feet were starting to hurt even when I was wearing flats or sneakers or flip-flops. I mean, really everything. So I figured, all right, I better go get this checked out. Who knows? Maybe it's serious. So I made an appointment with a podiatrist. A foot specialist, and you know, he took one look at me, look at my feet, and said, "Oh, you have bunions." And I got to tell you, Amanda, that totally freaked me out. Bunions, you know, that's something grandmas and great-grandmas have. I mean, here I hadn't even pushed middle age yet at that point, and he's telling me I have bunions. I didn't even really know what bunions were, but it just sounded like this horrible thing. You know, the first word that popped in my head is onions, yuck, you know? So, so anyway, I got a very quick education, and luckily for me, it just so happened that this podiatrist whom I made the appointment with had a very conservative approach to dealing with bunions. Thank goodness, because since you're a New Yorker, you know on the subway there are all these ads for surgery for people who have bunions. But, and so I asked him, I said, do you think I need to have surgery? He said, oh, no, absolutely not. He said, first of all, your bunions are mild, so you wouldn't need it. He said, but in any event, I don't advocate surgery for this type of thing, which was very good. And we can talk about that in a moment if you want to hear more, because it's very scary how some people are jumping into getting the foot surgery. But the end of the long story is he told me what I need to do to protect my feet, and there's really a genetic component to bunions, and 70% of all people, not just women, men too, walk in such a way that they are very likely to get bunions eventually. It's called overpronation, when you walk with the insides of your feet kind of rolling in a little bit. It's extremely common, and over time, people who overpronate probably will develop bunions. It may happen, you know, for me in my 30s. It may happen for somebody else in her 60s or 70s, but it is an extremely common thing. And there are many ways to stave it off. One of the things to do, I learned, is to have a complete lifestyle change in terms of footwear. So I did all this research and ended up blogging about it, and it just really developed into this book.
Well, and one thing I've always wondered about high heels in particular, which obviously can cause more than just bunions, but also knee and back and all sorts of horrible problems if you wear them all the time.
Absolutely.
Fashions, like, come and go, and hemlines, they go up and down, but high heels seem to be permanently in style.
Yeah, that's true.
Why is this?
Well, it makes total sense. When a woman wears high heels, she gains sex appeal instantly. Heels change her posture. They make your body look more curvaceous. Your legs seem longer. Your gait becomes sexier. There's a reason that sex symbols always wear high heels. So women like heels, and heterosexual men like to look at women wearing high heels. And I like high heels, too. I'm not putting it down. I'm just trying to be careful not to wear them too much now, because if I do, I hurt. But, you know, I'm not the shoe police. I'm not telling anybody to stop wearing them.
You look into the long history of, like, it's not just high heels, but there are, like, other ways that women's feet have been cobbled, including Chinese foot binding. And it always seems like it comes back to that, just, you know, sexiness. Is there a connection between women's feet, pain, and sexiness, or is it just...
that's really interesting. Wow, I don't know if I know the answer to that question, but I can tell you that women's shoes and feet are fetish objects. Do you know what a fetish means exactly?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because a lot of people think that the word fetish is something having to do with, you know, sadomasochistic sexuality. But the word fetish actually just means an object that we ascribe magical or supernatural powers to. So even without all of the sexual connotations, you know, you could fetishize any type of object, actually. But Freud, very interestingly, talked about, in the early 1900s, he wrote this essay about fetishes where he talked very specifically about women's shoes and feet as fetish objects. And it's a really fascinating essay. He talked about castration anxiety for boys and men, and I'm oversimplifying a bit, but he basically argued that a young boy, when he discovers that mommy doesn't have a penis, this is, you know, traumatic for him, because in his mind, mommy once upon a time did have a penis, but it was taken away, and if that happened to mommy, that could happen to him too. And according to Freud, the boy who's looking up at his mother the last thing he sees, and for whatever reason, she's always wearing a dress or skirt in this scenario, the last thing he sees before he looks up and you know, has this horrible, traumatic discovery is he sees her foot or her shoe, and that becomes a fetish, a replacement object for female sexuality, female genitals. And so there, according to Freud, that is why so many men are so interested in women's feet and shoes. Now, I mean, you and I can laugh and say, wow, that's such a ludicrous and far-fetched scenario, and it is. But I think that Freud actually was onto something. You know, whether or not we agree with this particular scenario, I think that he was right that so many of us, and not just little boys and not just men, do fetishize women's feet and shoes, and they do seem to have this power that other parts of our body or other, you know, clothing objects don't seem to have. And I do think it is very much tied in with sexuality. I do think that Freud was right that a woman's foot or shoe can be a stand-in for her sexuality in general.
Well, even if you don't agree with the, like, elaborate scenario that he painted, which is a bit elaborate, like, it does seem to make sense that you're a small child, you're on the ground, you know, you're forming your opinion of the world, and mostly what you're looking at are feet.
True.
So books like yours would probably be kind of depressing if you didn't offer women hope.
I hope it's not depressing. And as I said, I'm not telling anybody to go into your closet, haul all of your stilettos together and bring them over to the Salvation Army and get rid of them. I would never do that. And I have not done that myself. You know, the message I want women to come away with is wear your high heels judiciously, wear them sparingly, save them for the special occasions. You know, for myself, I wear heels once or twice a week for a few hours at a time, and that's it. I don't walk around in them. I certainly don't dance in them. You know, you just have to be careful. If you're sitting, having dinner in a restaurant, or you're at a show, or even if you're standing at a cocktail party but you didn't walk there in them, fine, wear your heels. I wouldn't say that you have to wear orthopedic shoes all the time. But when you are not in those special occasion scenarios, you know, you really should wear shoes that are quote-unquote good for you, not shoes that are bad for you. And that means either shoes that have built-in support for your arches, especially if you're a pronator, and as I said, 70% of us are pronators, or you could insert arch supports if your shoes don't have them, or just wear shoes that are well-made, that give you support, and that you're not going to totter in.
Well, I think a lot of people, when they think of orthopedic shoes, have this, like, horrifying image of, like, these really ugly shoes that are just undoable because they're either ugly or they're unprofessional looking, you know, especially for women. But you have a whole section of your book where you dispute that myth.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you mean by orthopedic. You are right, there certainly are some hideous orthopedic shoes out there. I mean, I cannot tell a lie. That is true. However, the manufacturers that put out these shoes have been getting more sophisticated and savvy in terms of fashion over the last few years. This is actually a pretty good time if you want to start exploring shoes that are good for you. I don't know if the word orthopedic is necessary, but shoes that are well made and that do provide some support. They're getting cuter and cuter and more fashionable each season. So, I mean, every season when I go check them out, I always think, oh, wow, these are so nice. Why didn't they have these 3 years ago when I needed them for this event or that event? So, and I'm pretty optimistic. The shoe manufacturers are just getting much more savvy about this.
My guest today has been Leora Tannenbaum. She's the author of Bad Shoes and the Women Who Love Them. It's published by Seven Stories Press, and it's available at bookstores online and at your local bookstore. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Leora.
Thank you so much, Amanda. This was a lot of fun.
The healthcare bill passed into law, and I think at this point many people are ready to wash their hands and move on. But just because the bill became law doesn't mean that the ever so slow rollout of all the various provisions will proceed perfectly and smoothly. For the time being, healthcare is going to be political, and not just because every other challenger candidate this season is running on it. It's also because there's various parts of the law that are going to require a lot of interpretation and handling, starting with birth control, as the AP reported.
Free birth control under health care? As health reform regulations begin to take shape, Planned Parenthood has begun a quiet campaign to ensure that birth control is counted among the free preventive services that health insurers must cover under the Affordable Care Act. Birth control barely came up in the health care reform debate, brushed aside by the more heated debate over abortion language and coverage. But with numerous religious groups opposed to contraceptive use, this issue is all but certain to become a flashpoint as implementation moves forward.
You can already hear 1,000 anti-choicers trying to explain how Planned Parenthood is asking the federal government to cover women's pill prescriptions, and it's just a matter of Planned Parenthood trying to make more money. They haven't been thwarted from using the "it's only for the money" argument against Planned Parenthood because they're a nonprofit, and so I don't imagine they'll be stopped by the realization that Planned Parenthood is actively agitating for the government to reduce their income that they make from selling contraception. Or maybe not, for once. As Robin Marty at RH Reality Check pointed out to me, this possibility that healthcare reform will mandate free contraception comes right as a major break could be opening up in the anti-choice movement between the hardline anti-contraception folks that dominate the movement and the National Association of Evangelicals, who has tentatively decided that if contraception reduces the abortion rate, they're going to swallow their antagonism towards sexually active unmarried women and begrudgingly support it. The NAE stepping away from the hardline anti-sex message and supporting contraception access has to be a big blow to the anti-choice movement, but it could make the path towards making contraception easier to get and afford that much smoother. To make it even harder on opponents of contraception, the amendment that could make this possible was written with contraception specifically in mind.
The groups have at least one big supporter, Mikulski, who intended her amendment to cover birth control as preventive care. Her intention was to have preventive services provided for women at no additional cost, no deductibles, Mikulski spokeswoman Rachel McKnight said. From her perspective, that includes everything from heart disease screening and diabetes screening to mammograms to birth control.
The changes go into effect on September 23rd, and that means they'll be rolled out into all applicable healthcare plans by January 1st. At the same time, we'll be facing another change being rolled out. This time it's the provision in the law that requires insurance companies to cover their policyholders' children until those children are 26. Previously, once you graduated college, you were out. For even healthy young women, getting kicked off when you graduated college could be a big problem if they were on some kind of prescription birth control. Under this new law, they'll be able to continue getting their prescriptions covered without a break. But that benefit hasn't kicked in yet, as NPR explained.
Jackson Kahn graduated this weekend from Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. The biochemistry and biophysics major is taking a year off to teach before pursuing graduate studies. His mom, June Blender, said she was delighted when the provision letting young adults stay on their parents' health plans remained in the bill that was signed into law. But then she was disappointed when she learned that it doesn't take effect right away and that her employer, Microsoft, wasn't going to make it available to Jackson until the next open season for benefits this fall.
Usually, this kind of government foot-dragging wouldn't be such a big deal, but in this case, I think there's a good reason to be concerned. We're in the middle of a recession, and that means jobs aren't easy to come by for recent graduates, which means that many more of them will be finding themselves uninsured. When it comes to pregnancy prevention, this is going to be a huge burden. Already you're seeing demand for abortions going up, and abortion funds are reporting a huge jump in the number of women asking for help. What's going to happen when you dump a bunch of newly uninsured women at the peak of their fertility out there? In some cases, the insurance companies are just going ahead and starting the coverage in June, but in others, not so much.
According to the new law, health plans are required to start offering coverage to young adults who are no longer students, starting on the first policy renewal date after September 23rd. For many plans, that will mean January 1st of next year. That will leave a multi-month gap for a lot of graduating college seniors.
That's a lot of months to wait for health insurance. And it's not just the people graduating now, but also anyone under 26 who will be eligible then but isn't right now. Young people are a huge percentage of the uninsured, So when this is all finally resolved, we'll start to see the effects of health outcomes for this group, including young women at risk for unintended pregnancy. But it seems like we can't even start observing the major changes until January of 2011. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Getting to see a doctor is just like slavery edition. Or that seems to have been Glenn Beck's point when he said this about healthcare reform.
Our children and our grandchildren, it is morally reprehensible to enslave them right. So we can go gamble, right. Take a risk.
The public is already beginning to see how much reliable healthcare improves your freedom to do things like change jobs or get more education. So Beck's trying to redefine that freedom as slavery. Very 1984, and kind of bizarre considering that it's not like they're going to get this law overturned by complaining about it on Fox News.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.